Welcome to the second of two special OnFIF podcasts on global currencies and the outlook for 2019. I'm Ben Robinson, Deputy Head of Research at OnFIF, and I'm joined by Simon Derrick, Chief Currency Strategist at BNY Mellon.
Moving away from the euro and thinking about emerging markets, I think that the elephant in the room here is always going to be China and the renminbi. And I think one of the really fascinating things to me is China's been slowing steadily this year. And yes, of course, the significant factor behind that has been the trade wars. You know, look at the start of the trade conflict story. It emerges in February and March when the Chinese markets start going down. February and March, it's not long after that that authorities start to allow the renminbi to weaken. But one of the really fascinating things over the course of the last month and a half is how, as that Fed rhetoric, that softer Fed rhetoric, let's for the want of a better phrase call it the Fed put, has become rather more apparent. Despite that weakness in the Chinese economy, you've started to see a stabilization of the currency and, interestingly enough, in the local equity markets as well. And in fairness, if you're looking at quite a few of the indicators that you tend to look at when considering the future direction of the renminbi, there are things out there that start to suggest that next year could start to see modest renminbi strength. If we have a weak dollar, you know, relatively speaking, declining yields, that could precisely be the environment that could see exactly a repeat of what we were seeing in the first half of the previous decade.
A strengthening renminbi, of course, could be beneficial in this sort of trade war with the US. It may ease some of the tensions there. But at the same time, of course, they, in a way, want the opposite, the Chinese, to happen because of their huge increase in debt over the last few decades. Clearly, a stronger exchange rate against the dollar doesn't help them in that regard. So it's a bit of a mixed bag there in terms of how it will actually affect the country. So what do you think all of this means for the economy going forward in 2019?
I think that's a very, very good point. And I think you have to kind of pick it apart in two separate ways. I think that, of course, there's a good argument that the renminbi should weaken, but probably weaken against the basket of currencies against that rather than against just the dollar. Secondly, again, maybe you know, the most consistent theme of this podcast is politics comes back to play. First of all, it was fairly clear from a lot of the rhetoric over the course of the latter half of 2018 that there was a concern about break below 7 for the yuan. Equally, there was a concern appeared that the foreign exchange reserve number shouldn't fall much below $3 trillion. And of course, those two things were incompatible. You can't, if you're trying to defend the currency, you would think that that would lead to a drain on the foreign exchange reserves. But much as in January 2015, when this impossible conundrum came up, it was an outside factor that really managed to, I think, help the China out. And then much as in January 2015, it was a change of stance from the Fed. Now, from the perspective of the US, you could argue that everybody's a winner to this particular game. The yuan strengthens. You get easier interest rates in the US at the same time. You end up with an easing in the political tensions. What's not to like? Now, it is absolutely right that, of course, it puts China in a tougher position in terms of its currency. But you could also argue that it allows them to have more flexibility on monetary policy, that they can ease rates a little easier than if the currency was under permanent downward pressure. Also, there is a pretty good argument to say that over the course of the last 20 years, really from the Asian crisis in 98 onwards, that China has proved highly sensitive to the volatility that the yuan could create in external markets. And therefore, I think that if you look to what was happening this summer, when you started to see some of the renminbi weakness being reflected in the performance of other regional markets, particularly those that had a strong trade connection to China, directly or indirectly, I think there was awareness that if the yuan was allowed to weaken substantially, though there was heightened volatility in that market, that it can feed through into a negative loop into a lot of different markets. So is there a downside to a stronger renminbi? Yes, of course there is. But there's an awful lot of upsides So having a currency that isn't collapsing. And then maybe the final thing to think about on this particular front is to, again, simply go back to late 2014, early 2015, and just think about the sheer drain on the foreign exchange reserves that was emerging at the time. Again, in 2016, there were points in that period when China was spending $100 billion a month to try and protect the currency. It's an awful lot easier if you have a Fed that is proving rather more cautious on interest rates. And I guess what that really means is that when we talk about the Fed put, the key bit to think about is it's not just about US markets. It tends to be a global put nowadays.
Of course, the IMF estimates the size of this renminbi block to be around 30% of global GDP, made up of mostly Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, and some of the other sort of BRICS grouping of countries. And so I guess what you're saying is that a stronger renminbi helps them to an extent, because I suppose it what boosts Chinese imports from them and should help reduce the current account deficit. What's the mechanism that might help those countries within the renminbi block to improve?
I think it's very simple. It's about trade. And maybe the perfect example of this is to think again back to this summer. And just two very simple examples. If I think about the performance of Japanese equity markets over the course of the last 10, 12 years, there was a very simple argument to be made, given that Japan had a strong export-focused economy, that what happened in local equity markets more often than not tended to be a reflection of what the currency was doing. That when the yen was strengthening against the dollar, the topics would tend to be weakening and vice versa. And the correlations became incredibly high for long periods over the course of the last decade or so. What was interesting this summer was that there were periods where the strongest correlation on the currency side to what was happening in Japanese markets was not between the dollar against the yen, but between the renminbi against the yen. And when you were seeing the renminbi weakening steadily against the yen, that was the point that you were starting to see pressure come to bear on Japanese equity markets. So I think that that idea that you're starting to see the importance of the yuan as a key trade partner in a wide range of regional markets. And when I say that, this is clearly stretching all the way out to Australia and New Zealand. I think that matters. What you can say more generally, I think, this year that emerged was a re-emergence, if you like, of those fears that we had in 2013 about high levels of foreign currency denominated debt, weak current accounts, and therefore a high exposure to whatever the Fed was doing and the dollar was doing.
Let's take that idea of vulnerability. You mentioned high levels of debt, weak current accounts, and the real vulnerabilities that this creates in terms of exposure to what the Fed does. Now, over the last two decades, there has been a large-scale shift away from fixed exchange rates in a lot of emerging countries towards floating exchange rates and a huge buildup of foreign exchange reserves. So do you think that this means another emerging markets crisis on the scale of the 80s and 1990s is unlikely, especially given this huge political context, the backdrop of monetary policy tightening? In other times, perhaps this could have been a massive area for concern. Where do you think we stand now in terms of protection against vulnerability?
So I think the first thing is that the world has changed massively over the last 15 years. Clearly, the Asian crisis in 1998 proved a huge spur to the growth of foreign exchange reserves. And so whilst clearly I think that many nations would have preferred not to see a weakening dollar through that period from 2002 onwards, what it did allow them to do was build up that huge buffer. And in fairness, the buffer became so extreme in China's case that by November 2013, at the time of the third plenum, they're effectively saying that the addition of further foreign exchange reserves beyond the $4 trillion that they already had at the time was probably going to be more of a hindrance than a help to them. So there was a point where you actually had too much. So clearly, from the perspective of do some nations, not all, there's plenty of nations out there that really don't have that much in terms of reserves to protect the currency, but do they have far greater buffers than they had 10, 15 years ago? Yes, absolutely. The flip side to that, though, is that the last 15 years has also really proved there are limits to the effectiveness of intervention when trying to protect your currency. And again, China is the perfect example of this. And when they ended up spending $100 billion plus a month to try and stop the currency weakening, but equally Russia in late 2014, the astonishing amounts reserves they were spending. And they had north of $500 trillion in memory reserves when the crisis first started to hit, yet they were forced to break the ban and to go for a free floating currency. So there are limits. So yes, they do have a bigger buffer. Yes, it must make life a little easier, but I'm not convinced that actually large foreign exchange reserves really are the panacea for protecting your currency.
But combined with the floating exchange rate rather than the fixed exchange rate, which was the case a lot of the time during the 1990s in particular, that combination of factors, does that reduce further this vulnerability?
Yes, it does. I mean, and I'm a big believer that when we look back at the financial history of this decade, in a couple of decades' time, we'll see that one of the key stories was China's move towards currency liberalization. I think that that is a key story. Now, this is a very slow and a very long process. I mean, you remember, you know, the currency was pegged all the way through until July of 2005, and here we are 13 years later, and we're still talking about currency liberalization. It is very clearly stated in China's 10-year plan that that's where they're looking for interest rate, capital account, and currency liberalization. And certainly, I think that's exactly where we're going. So I do think the move towards more flexible currencies, which I think is a good thing, not a bad thing. I guess, you know, speaking from the perspective of the UK and the pound and what I've seen elsewhere, the ability of the currency to be able to take the strain has been a key factor. If you look back at 1992 in the UK, the breaking out of the exchange rate mechanism and getting a competitively priced currency and the ability to be able to set monetary policy at the appropriate levels was a key factor behind the boom that lasted for the next 13, 14 years in the UK. So from that perspective, that move towards freer exchange rates, I think, is an important factor, because the whole point of having a currency at the end of the day is to act as a buffer, is to allow that greater flexibility so that when something comes along, when there's a political uncertainty that leads to a slowdown in growth, it's not refracted straight back into the economy, but there's something there that can take a little bit of the strain.
Well, it's interesting to see what's happened if we do take the UK example, because since the fall in sterling, our exports really have increased quite a lot. And most importantly, the returns on our foreign investments in obviously much higher currency value terms now that we've had a depreciation of our currency, the current account deficit has narrowed quite substantially. And that is clearly quite an effective mechanism for absorbing some of these challenges when you do have a massive currency shock like this. So obviously there's a lot more going on behind the scenes here. And obviously the UK is quite a unique example to the extent that it has such large net foreign assets, but clearly the exchange rate is key there. I just want to move on to one final issue, which we haven't really talked about, although we have alluded to it slightly, which is oil prices. They remain far below their peak earlier in the year, despite the fact that there was this OPEC agreement, which seems really unlikely to provide much of a floor, meaning, at least that's what it seems, that there will be a period of continued low prices for the foreseeable future. So if this does contribute to lower inflation among importers, do you think some central banks might respond by loosening monetary policy? Because we know that fears of this have contributed to a weaker Turkish lira, for example. Do you share this concern, this fear, and do you think that this will be an important factor in currency markets or just a sort of marginal one?
I don't know that I think it's a fear. It's always interesting to contextualize these things. If we go back to 2005, 2006, 2007. Okay, a decade ago. So you've obviously got to take into account what's happened over that time in terms of, you know, moves in real price. But the move through $60 a barrel that you saw in late 2007 as the Fed started to cut rates was seen as a shock to the market, was seen as a shock to the global economy. If you think about the astonishing slowdown you saw in 2008 in US, one of the contributory factors was the dollar price that headed beyond $100 a barrel. So I'm not that certain that from the perspective of consumers that we should be that frightened or consider it that unnatural that you could, and this is all hypothetical, but that you could have an oil price that was trading at, let's say, $50. Or $40 a barrel. Would that be that dramatic? Well, probably not. Probably the only places that that would have a significant negative impact would be on oil producers. And there, I think, is kind of the interesting issue and the dynamics that that would drive over the next few years. How that plays out is obviously, again, really truly about politics and geopolitics. It's probably beyond the scope of this, but I do think that it's interesting the changing dynamics that you've seen in OPEC in recent years, the increased importance that OPEC Plus, that the contribution Russia makes to that debate, and the politics more generally of the Middle East. It's endlessly shifting. This is part of a story that's been playing out for several hundred years, and certainly has been playing out with the current actors for at least 50 years now. So it's part of a constantly changing environment. But from the perspective of consumers and net importers, if it allows central banks to have a rather more relaxed tone, yeah, I think that's probably a good thing rather than a bad thing. If it allows consumers a little more flexibility in terms of spending. And going into what appears to be a slowdown in global growth, and certainly from the perspective of the UK and the numbers that have been coming out in recent weeks, suddenly a slowdown in UK growth, should we be that worried about an easier oil price? No, I don't think so.
I think that's probably an excellent point to leave the podcast. We've covered a lot of grounds. Thank you very much for your comments. It seems that 2019 is certainly set to be another very interesting year for currency markets. And I think we look forward to seeing how the developments that we've discussed here play out. So thank you very much for your comments, Simon. Thank you for joining us. I think it's been an excellent discussion.